Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9 to 5 for a 5 to 9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Mark Reardon Show. Brad Young sitting in today for Mark Reardon. He should be back on Monday, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. He should be back in. But in the meantime, I get to have fun today. Today is my golf outing. I get to leave my law firm work behind, which is challenging, and I get to have fun and hang out with the cool kids like Sue Thomas. Hi, Sue.
Hello. I almost said good morning. Sorry. It's been a really long week.
Need more coffee. Yeah. That's my answer to everything, more coffee. But whenever I'm in on Fridays, I like to call it the Reardon-less Roundtable. Because Mark's not here, and we get to have fun. So joining us today on the Reardon-less Roundtable is Gene Evans. Everybody knows Gene. Gene's a political consultant for Go Consulting.
Yeah,
for I don't get applause. You get applause. That's great.
I'm honored.
I just usually get a boot in the backside. Former executive director of the Missouri GOP, former state rep, head of the Missouri Federation for Children. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule today.
My pleasure.
And also Ted House, a former circuit judge, presiding, including the presiding judge of the 11th Circuit, former Missouri state senator and state rep. Ted House, good to see you, sir.
Thank you, Brad. Great to be back.
Thanks for being in. We had a great talk beforehand. Our green room here consists of three chairs and buy your own drinks. So it's not much of a green room. It's a kind of a budget green room, but we got to chat beforehand. And there's a lot of stuff going on today. And of course, also President Trump just finished a press conference on the tarmac in New Jersey. Not a lot of new information other than some proposals, maybe, or just ideas about how to deal with illegal immigration when it comes to farmers and what they might have to do to take responsibility for that. But there's plenty of other stuff to talk about. And I want to kick this off regarding Iran. Right now, this is a big issue. And I want to start with Ted, because right now, President Trump has given Iran basically a 2-week deadline to say, come and negotiate, or the U.S. could enter, not boots on the ground. Of course, that's been ruled out. But the potential for airstrikes, including using so-called bunker busters with our B-2 stealth bomber, which is based right over at Whiteman Air Force Base over on the western side of Missouri. But from your perspective, I want to start with this. Israel did preemptive strikes against Iran. So I want to start with the idea, was that beneficial, yes or no? And then talk about what should the U.S. involvement be?
So, Brad, I am of the belief that the largest sponsor of terrorism in the world should not be allowed to develop and have a nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. I think that would be, if anybody would be likely to use it, it would be Iran. And so I support the effort to make sure that never happens. One of the things that, you know, as the Democrat on this panel, you always look for good and positive things about the other folks, you know. And
sure.
One of the things about President Trump that I like and appreciate is his propensity to not get involved in wars. And I think that's really what he wants to stay out. He wants to end wars and not start them. So I'm also an advocate of the United States Constitution, and I believe that it's clear that Congress is the branch of government that should declare war. And so I'm not real keen about the executive branch making a unilateral decision to go to war, because bombing a country is an act of war, of course. And unless it's, you know, there's an emergency or it's an imperative to, a preemptive strike or to strike back. But in this case, there's time to consider this. And I just would like for the United States Congress to implement its prerogative under the U.S. Constitution to be the branch of government that declares war before we start bombing people.
And Gene, before I go to you, I just want to follow up, Ted, because you've just opened a colossal can of worms here. And I just want to briefly, not that I want to spend a lot of time on it, but briefly, there's been debate over the last 50 years, starting with the War Powers Act in the 70s, about whether Congress can, to some extent, delegate that authority to the president. And the vice versa is, of course, that as the commander in chief, any restrictions placed upon it by Congress could potentially be unconstitutional. But do you consider, for example, from your perspective, would just dropping two bunker buster bombs on Iranian facilities, maybe in Natanz or Fordo, would that in of itself, from your perspective, I mean, obviously you're a retired judge, but from your perspective, would that trigger the need for congressional approval under the war powers of the Congress, or could that be deemed an exercise of authority as the commander in chief?
Well, as you know, there is some Supreme Court precedent on this, but in my view, that would be an act of war that the U.S. Constitution would require Congress to authorize specifically before we get involved to that level. I want to mention, I'm glad you mentioned Whiteman Air Force Base. My political mentor was U.S. Congressman Ike Skelton.
Mm-hmm.
And
legend.
Yeah, he is, and I worked for Ike, and he was responsible for getting the B-2 based at Whiteman Air Force Base, and there's a certain amount of pride that comes with Missouri hosting that capacity. But I digress. I just think this is not an emergency like a 2 minute or a 24 hour emergency. I think we have time to contemplate all of the consequences of that act of war. I'm not saying I don't favor doing it, because mm-hmm. I think it ultimately may need to be done. But let's follow the Constitution.
Gene, your thoughts. Number one, was it just kind of revisiting the topic here? Number one, was Israel right to take a preemptive strike on Iran? And number two, whether and to what extent the U.S. should get involved in that situation right now?
Well, Israel certainly thinks that their existence was at stake if they didn't strike. And it's interesting that, you know, Trump said they need to do something in the next 60 days, and then it was on day 61 that Israel struck. So I think there was some hints there. There's so much going on here behind the scenes that none of us know about, right?
True.
Anytime they have these things. And I will point out that it's not unprecedented for a president to order strikes. We've seen it with Democrats and Republicans without having a declaration of war. Whether that's right or not, I can see the constitutional thing, but there certainly is a precedent that has happened many, many times. I think that the president has done a really good job in terms of kind of letting folks know that he's engaged, but not saying what he is or isn't going to do, which is a great negotiation tactic.
Yes, it is.
When I was in Israel, which for folks who don't know, Israel's about the size of New Jersey. It's a tiny little speck where all of its neighbors, for the most part, hate it.
Hopefully cleaner than New Jersey, but go ahead.
Yes. But they one of the things we learned when we were over there was that the Middle Eastern leaders, whether they support the U.S. or against the U.S., respect Trump because they feared him and because he's unpredictable. So a lot of things that many people in the United States maybe don't care for with this president does make him effective when it comes to negotiating with mm-hmm. these sort of terrorist regimes. They don't respond to, you know, nice talks at G7s or wherever, or things that were discussed, you know, with the Red Cross. That's not how they operate. And so having a president who knows how to negotiate and who also is somewhat unpredictable is an advantage in this particular instance, whether you agree with what he's doing or not.
Right.
And I do think the 2 week, what he said was, I'm going to decide in 2 weeks. Basically, he's given himself an out either way, right?
Yes,
but he's
yes,
also
yes.
let them know something. If we don't get this together in 2 weeks, we don't know what he's going to do. And we do know he has the capability with the United States to blow mm-hmm. Iran basically off the map. So I think he's done a pretty good job here. I don't know what's going to happen. I hate war. I'd like the killing to end. But I also think the Israelis are always fighting for their existence.
Right. What I like about this topic is this. This is one of those topics where reasonable minds on both sides of the aisle can agree 90% of the way. And I like that. I think all reasonable minds can agree, number one, Iran poses an existential threat to Israel. Number two, we don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. And number three, we're going to support Israel. Most people agree with those tenets. And I think that's basically indisputable. Now, what I like about the negotiation here and the 2 week deadline is this. I negotiate for a living. A lot of us negotiate for a living. And by giving this two-week deadline, you're creating leverage to say, come to the negotiating table and let's see if we can work this out. You're putting pressure on the situation and you're striving to create a death-free resolution to the situation.
Right.
And I like that. Mm-hmm. I hope that that produces a resolution to this issue. But I'm glad that we're standing up for Israel. And I'm glad that we're standing up for one of the sole democracies that are in the Middle East. We need them as an ally. They need us. Hey, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some immigration issues. Number one, talking about the Dodgers denying ICE entry at Dodger Stadium, but also we have the issue of this ongoing issue, for example, in L.A. about Trump's deployment of the National Guard. We'll break down some of that next on the Reardonless Roundtable this afternoon. Brad Young sitting in for Mark on 97.1. FM Talk. Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show. Brad Young in today. Thanks for hanging out with us. We're also joined, as you know, by friends of the show, you know, Gene Evans and Ted House. And I want to dive into immigration. There was an incident at Dodger Stadium. We don't really know all the details, and I don't think that's a great topic to discuss. But earlier, and we got some guidance this week from the Ninth Circuit, but I want to start with you, Gene, because one of the issues that we had in California, to me, it was a classic battle of who has the power.
Right.
We have the Governor Gavin Newsom saying, I don't want to bring out the National Guard. President Trump requested it. He denied. National Guard troops are historically under the control of the governors. In this point, President Trump exercised his rights under Title 10 and said, I'm going to call out the National Guard anyway because there's a national security issue with regard to the riots. He calls them out. The lawsuit starts. But before we dive into the legal side of it, which I'm probably going to do in more detail later in the show today, just from your perspective, was it warranted for the calling out of the troops? And did President Trump handle this rightly or wrongly?
Yeah, I think, and from some of the reporting I've heard, he was regretful that he didn't do more in the summer of 20 when there was so much property damage and the burning of federal buildings. I heard an interview on this station with the former mayor of Ferguson about how he was advised by leaders to let protesters burn the police station and let them vent that way. And I think that Trump was like, you know, this, I'm going to go with my gut. I'm not going to let them destroy homes or property. And you see these clips, these viral clips of people trying to get to work, working people who've got kids in the car and they're trying to get to work and the protesters won't let them through. And you think, like, this is very disruptive to lives. And when they shut down one of the busiest highways in the middle of LA, maybe somebody's trying to get to the hospital or trying to get to their medication or try to get home. It's very disruptive, and I truly believe it was the right thing to do. I think it prevented a lot of violence. It's hard to know, but a presence is one of the most important things that police will tell you. I mean, think about it. If you're going down 270 and you see a cop car with a radar, their radar gun might not even be on, but everybody slows down just because of that presence. And so that presence has a calming effect. And, you know, the National Guard doesn't typically get involved with, I mean, they might do some crowd control, but that's not typically what they do. But they were protecting federal buildings. They did not want to see a federal building burn, which happened in the summer of 20. So I applaud it. I think it was the right thing to do. And I think he prevented what could have been a very tragic situation in L.A.
Ted House, Gavin Newsom, was he right or wrong here in refusing to allow the National Guard to be dispersed when it wasn't just the possibility of riots? We saw riots. It wasn't the possibility of property damage. We saw property damage. Was Gavin Newsom right or wrong here?
So let's be very clear. Anybody who vandalizes property is subject to being arrested and should be arrested. Anybody who blocks a street illegally should be arrested. Anybody who threatens the physical safety of others, especially including law enforcement officers, should be arrested. You know, if you're in my courtroom and you hurt a police officer, you were going to jail.
Yes. Boom.
And I've got police officers in my family, and that was something that no society should tolerate in terms of enforcing the law or bringing order. Having said that, we're concerned about our nation veering towards autocracy and concerned about preserving our democracy ideals. And the statement of Secretary of Homeland Security Noem Fyrst earlier saying that she didn't know what habeas corpus was, which is frightening because habeas corpus is what makes America America. That's why we're not North Korea. And then saying that she favored using the military because she wanted to liberate the people of Los Angeles from the mayor and the governor that they elected. Those every freedom-loving American should be very concerned about those kinds of statements and President Trump appointing those kinds of people.
Right, but rhetoric and actions are completely different. And even though we saw that rhetoric from Kristi Noem, which I agree, if she doesn't know what habeas corpus means, she could call me anytime and I'll explain it in very simple terms and I'll use crayons and flannel graph just to make sure she understands it. But in this instance, though, what we saw when President Trump put the boots on the ground, there was no law enforcement going on with them. They were simply there to protect federal buildings, to protect federal employees in a way that the police were demonstrating they couldn't handle. I don't see what the problem is.
So to answer your question, Brad, I think it's a terrible precedent. I mean, for the president to call out National Guard against the wishes of the governor of the state, no matter red state, blue state, doesn't matter. And of course, the use of the military is a really bad idea. You know, U.S. Marines are trained to blow things up and kill people. They're not law enforcement officers. And to put them in that situation is not fair to them. And ultimately, using the U.S. military against the people of the United States is just a really bad idea. Now, whether the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately rules, you know, one way or the other with regard to the National Guard, you know, when the governor doesn't want it or the mayor doesn't want it, we'll find that out before long. I just think it's a really bad precedent. Was it, you know, did it help? Was it necessary? We don't really know. The Los Angeles police seemed to have the situation under control. You know, we had millions of Americans in the streets last weekend, you know, protesting for democracy and freedom and to uphold the rule of law and the Constitution. And they were largely, you know, peaceful and nonviolent. I think it was an overreaction and a politicization of the situation that didn't need to occur. Trump thrives on chaos and division, and
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses like Rise Bakery connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Exacerbated the situation worse than it was.
He does, but I want to get back to Eugene because right now, I mean, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, in my mind, typically is about as popular as a James Carville kissing booth.
Right.
All right. And so because they're
very left.
They're very left wing, and yet in this instance, they seem to have gotten it right. But how do you respond to this idea that we're setting this dangerous precedent? Because I don't agree with it. But how do you agree?
Okay, so give me an example of when this has been done before.
Oh, sure. We all know the civil rights during the 1960s, and the governor, I forgot exactly which state it was. I think it was may have been Arkansas or Mississippi, but one of those states where they would not allow the integration of schools.
Right.
The governor said, I'm not going to do it, and the president had to exercise these rights under Title 10 to do that.
Absolutely.
And to me, even though you take it out of the segregation circumstance, the issue is still the same, that there are rights of individuals in California that are being threatened.
Mm-hmm.
The cops are obviously not equipped to handle this, and the use of National Guard troops was solely and exclusively to guard federal property and to protect federal agents. I don't see the problem with it.
Yeah, well, and again, so this wasn't like this was the first time this was done. It's been done before in these circumstances. This is not an everyday occasion, though, certainly. But this is extraordinary times, and we're so polarized, right? I don't fear for democracy. I was more worried about democracy in this country when we had a president who wasn't functioning. And it just galls me that Democrats are screaming about, you know, democracy. And I'm like, you supported a president who clearly wasn't functioning. Someone else was in charge, someone who was not democratically elected. And then you pushed forward a candidate who was not democratically elected by your caucus. So the democracy claims seem very convenient when they're against Trump, but not when they're looking inwardly. I think, you know, I understand why this is fraught with peril. We don't like the idea of militarized streets, but you know what's worse than that?
Burning streets,
looting streets. People who cannot get to work or get home to their kids because folks are blocking the highway.
Hey, I would love to go back to you, Ted, but we're coming up on a break here. I got to go to a break. And after the break, though, we're going to talk about another Supreme Court case that came out this week, and that is the Supreme Court upholding Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care, I believe, is the politically correct way of saying that. So we're going to break that down next. This is the Reardon-less Roundtable. Had to spit that one out. Brad Young sitting in today. We'll be back right after this on 97.1 FM Talk. We've got a lot of great conversations going on the YouTube streaming channel. If you want to check that out, go to YouTube.com, put in Mark Reardon Show, and you can join the festivities. Unfortunately, though, you'll have to see that both Ted and I are follically challenged. Other than that, we're a decent-looking bunch. Brad Young sitting in today. And I wanted to go to this SCOTUS decision this week regarding gender-affirming care. Because, again, one of the things I loved about law school, and Ted, you probably love the same thing, were these ideas where you get different ideas and rights that are pitted against each other. And with this transgender-affirming care issue, you have the rights of the states, which have traditionally been overseeing states in charge of their own medical care that is delivered within the state. You get that versus this equal protection clause argument that's been put forward here. And so, Ted, I want to start with you. The Supreme Court ruled 6-3 this week that Tennessee could limit gender-affirming care when it comes to the transgender community. Your thoughts?
So I haven't read the opinion yet. I'm not surprised by the result on that. I guess, Brad, the concern I have about this as an issue is that it really involves a very small number of people. My heart goes out to the transgender families. I pray for their well-being. I think that what is being done in politics today to use these transgender families as a political scapegoat in the culture wars is despicable. It's a terrible thing. I don't know that anybody would want to be in that situation. And it's become a political football. And there's a strategy on the political right to make everything you can possibly make about transgender, make it about transgender, because, of course, I think people feel that it's a political winner.
But there's also a move on the political left from the same perspective, Ted, meaning that if you've got a kid, because, listen, when I was a kid, I was a moron. I mean, to say that I was an idiot isn't a strong enough word. And if I had gone to my folks when I was 8 and said, hey, I think I'm a girl, and they said, oh, great, well, then let's get some surgery done on you. That would have been a colossal mistake because I was a moron and an idiot, and those were my good points when I was 8. But there's this move on the left to say we need to do these actions, which is also a political movement to try to assert that kids know their ultimate destiny when they really don't even know what they're going to have for lunch. So I want to go to Eugene on this, and that is, should states be allowed to determine medical care within their own borders?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. So I 100% don't think that this kind of experimental medical care should be on children until there's more evidence to support that this is really what's in their best interest long term. That's my personal opinion. But this is really about rights, parents' rights, right? Like, does a parent have a right to say, I don't want to vaccinate my child? Does a parent have a right to say, my kid is transgender, they want to change genders? Where do their rights end and the state's rights take over? And I think that is a really interesting question that's going to continue to evolve. Mm-hmm. For me personally, growing up a tomboy, 100% tomboy, only wanted to play with boys, wanted to play sports, was a total jock, and did not think or do any girl things, right? I mean, I probably would have been targeted for this. On the other hand, the research I've seen has shown the vast majority of kids who are undergoing this treatment suffer from other mental health issues. Many of them are on the spectrum, or they have mm-hmm. other serious mental health things that are impacting them. And I wonder if they're really getting the care they need for those issues. And that concerns me, because adolescence is awful, and you go through so many different things. I wouldn't go through it again, if my life depended on it. I really wouldn't. But I think, are these kids truly getting the care they need, or were some folks saying, we're just going to she wants to be a boy or the boy wants to be a girl without really looking at what was going on with the kid, which we've seen in some cases. But the issue of who has rights here, I mean, I worked on and passed a bill that said you can't get married till you're an adult, right? You used to be able, they're marrying off, you know, kids at 11 and 12 years old in this state. And folks would say, well, if their parents are okay with it, then we should just let them. And I was like, no, we don't. So if the parent wants to let their kid go drinking, we don't let them go into a bar, right? So there is some question about where parents' rights end and the state start. Mm-hmm. I don't have the answers on that. But I think overwhelmingly, people feel like this sort of experimental medicine is best left for adults who can make their own decisions and not on children who are very vulnerable. And as you said, not always thinking clearly about, certainly not about long-term consequences.
Right. So, Ted, I want to go to you, and I'm going to skip the you gave me a low, slow pitch right over the plate there, talking about getting married when you're 12, because I was going to bring up my friends in Arkansas. But but we won't dive into our and assail our Arkansas listeners. But, Ted, in this instance, though, should life-changing medical decisions be made even by parents when it comes to children in situations where the children don't even really know what's best for themselves? And I'm thinking about even like in Africa, where genital mutilation, the United Nations has been coming out for decades against this idea of genital mutilation being forced by parents onto children. And I see something similar going on in this situation. At what point do we say, parents, just tap the brakes. If the kid wants to be, if Johnny wants to be Julie when he turns 18, he can make that decision for himself, but we shouldn't be forcing it on the child when they're 8.
I'm not a psychiatrist, and I also can't say, you know, if it would be the appropriate course of action in any given circumstance. But I know that these families do not make these decisions casually, mm-hmm. and they don't make them lightly. I understand it's actually very rare to have irreversible, you know, physical, surgical, and hormonal changes to a minor child. It's almost always done when the person attains adulthood. But again, my primary those things, the science of it, the psychiatry of it, I think those things will work its way out. You raise the fascinating issues about states' rights versus personal rights and individuals, mm-hmm. and I think those are unresolved also.
They are.
My primary concern right now is that you know, it gets down. Speaking of children, it almost gets down to an argument over who started it. You know. There's been transgender care for a long time, and we're seeing it used as a political football, and these transgender families scapegoated in the culture wars, and I just think it's hurtful and harmful and inappropriate.
Gene,
I you know, as a jock, you know, as somebody who came up with Title IX, I'm just so offended that people say, oh, it's only a handful of kids. What about all the girls and women who this impacts when they try to have a transgender play at sports with us? It's not
yes.
fair. It's not just people say, well, there's only a handful of kids.
Ah, there we go. We got the bell of
there's
appreciation.
Only a handful of kids in Missouri, but it impacts the females that are on those teams. And I don't think it's fair. And the other thing, when you talk about politicizing it, because I don't support that one thing, I get tagged with being anti-LGBTQ, which is not the case at all. I am 100% supportive of my friends, no matter where they fall in that spectrum. But the sports thing, yeah, it's been politicized because it impacts a lot more
yes.
young women, and it's just simply not fair.
So let me interject, Brad, if I may, before we go on. I don't want anybody to have an unfair competitive advantage in any sport. Okay, mm-hmm. I think people want basic decency and fairness, and nobody wants that to happen. The Missouri State High School Activities Association has a protocol in the rare instance in which there's a transgender child on a sports team, and they've been able to deal with that. So again, it's the political narrative is that there's hordes of transgenders taking over the Fort Zumwalt North High School swim team, and that's just not happening.
Right, but there are instances of it, and I've maintained for a long time that if women who identify as if men rather who identify as women can compete in women's sports, then I'm going to buy a motorcycle, I'm going to self-identify as a bicyclist, and I'm going to win every Tour de France for the next 15 years.
So let's find a solution for that's fair to everybody without
right. but
putting
my daughter,
these families through this kind of a political
Gene, you talked about Title IX. I want to interject this. My oldest daughter received a 4-year rowing scholarship to KU.
Awesome.
Now, all the rest of my family all went to Mizzou, I told my daughter the only way on God's green earth that you're going to KU is if they pay for it. And they did. Yeah. They actually did, okay? Yeah. But my point is, I wouldn't want to have my daughter competing against a man in the boat for the Title IX payments, and I think that's a problem, but go ahead.
Well, I also think it goes to safe spaces, and as, you know, somebody who I'm absolutely certain throughout my life, I have been in a woman's restroom where there has been someone who has gone through the transition, has been there, hasn't bothered anyone, gone about their business. You probably have experienced that and you didn't even know it, right?
Right.
But what we have seen is there are perverted people out there who take advantage of these kind of open door policies to get off. And it's not fair. This is one of the few spaces you can go. If you're a woman who's being harassed in any sort of way, one of the few places you can escape to is the women's restroom, yes, or the women's locker room where the guy can't come in. And we have seen cases of men, whether it's in some, they've been introduced to women's prison populations or just having these open door policies. I'm not talking about somebody who's truly transgender. I'm talking about somebody who's taking advantage of a policy that has a perversion. And it's not fair to women because we become victimized again. And if one of these people walk into a locker room with 30 people, all 30 of those young women are victimized by this. And it's not right. It's not fair. We have to have safe spaces for women.
We certainly agree that we need to protect children in, yep, all circumstances.
Absolutely. Hey, we're going to take a break here. I want to bring it back a little bit more local because we've been talking about some national issues. But one of the more local issues, and this again pits finances versus our heart allegiance, and that deals with the Kansas City Chiefs and the Royals. We had a situation this week where because Kansas City, or the state of Kansas rather, extended an offer to lure the Chiefs and the Royals over to Kansas, then we're in a situation where taxpayer money is going to be given to billionaires so that they can build their stadiums and keep their stadiums in the state of Missouri. We're going to talk about whether this is a good idea, bad idea, and what can be done about this. Brad Young sitting in today for Mark Reardon, joined, of course, by Gene Evans and Ted House. We'll be back right after this, 97.1 FM Talk. Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show, and I wanted to bring the show back a little bit more local because in St. Louis, and I got to tell you, full disclosure, I've still got some deep wounds from the loss of two different football teams. In fact, during the whole Rams debacle over on the Camo X side.
Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9-to-5 for a 5-to-9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Service is not available in all areas.
My favorite saying was that Stan Kroenke is to lying as Wisconsin is to cheese. And so, I've still got a little bitter taste in my mouth. But listen, that wound has been balmed, B-A-L-M-E-D, just to make sure you don't think I said bombed, by the fact that the Chiefs have been doing a great job. So emotionally, I'm right there. I want the Chiefs to stay in Missouri. I want the Royals to stay in Missouri for no other reason that I always say it's easier to look skinny when you stand next to a fat person. I like it that the Cardinals are compared to the Royals because we always look good, right? So we need them both in Missouri. Yet the libertarian in me says, do we really need to be giving state tax dollars to billionaires to build more and more extravagant stadiums so that they can go out and compare their stadium size with their other co-NFL owners? So, Gene, I want to start with you on this. You were in the legislature. We saw this the bill that was just came out, signed by the governor, extending tax credits and other incentives to keep the Chiefs and the Royals in Missouri. Your thoughts?
Yeah, this was a tough one. And there's a lot of folks, you know, myself included, who don't like the idea of tax breaks for, you know, millionaires, billionaires, so to be. But I think when you look at this particular case, there's a cost of doing this and there's a cost of not doing it. And, you know, when we lost the Rams, that money that would have been spent on the Rams was spent on other entertainment here locally in Missouri for the most part.
Yes.
If the Chiefs and the Royals go across into Kansas, the money's going to follow them. So the hundreds of millions of tax dollars that these entities bring in and the jobs they employ to Missouri residents would be gone. And the money would not, folks are still going to spend their money going to games. I mean, the folks that live in Lee's Summit are still going to drive over and go to a Chiefs game when it's over in Kansas, but the tax revenues are going to be in Kansas. And so I think a lot of the legislators that I talked to, that it came down to, no, I wasn't crazy about it, but the cost of not doing something, mm-hmm. the losses we would have had in terms of tax revenue are greater than the losses are of allowing them to keep some of the taxes that they bring in to invest in these bonds. It's kind of complicated, but it does make sense. It's not taking general revenue and giving it to them. It's allowing them to keep some of the tax revenue that they generate and apply it towards right. their rebuilding. I'm not saying I agree with that, but I'm saying like that was the way it was.
There is some rational basis.
Yes.
I always used, whenever I was visiting my daughter over at KU, I always used what I call the Norm Stewart rule, which was I would gas up my car in Missouri because I didn't want one penny of tax dollars that I spend going to the state of Kansas. And so when we had to get a hotel, I would literally stay in Kansas City, Missouri and drive to Lawrence because I didn't want any of my money going to the darn state of Kansas. So not that I've got an opinion on that, right? But Ted, you've got a resume as long as George Herbert Walker Bush had. Just, I mean, you've done everything, my friend.
Not quite some of the things he did, I appreciate it. Thank you. But
including serving in the legislature. So is this really something that we should be spending? And I'm not necessarily against it. I'm just raising the issue. Is this something we should be spending tax dollars on?
So, Brad, I know you want to keep it local, but you threw me a softball, and I have to preface my comments with Trump's big, beautiful bill, the budget bill in Washington, which in my view is a grotesque transfer of wealth from the poor to the rich. And the idea of subsidizing billionaires is a really, really tough thing. So specifically with regard to subsidizing billionaires that own sports teams, I will tell you that when I was in the Senate, I voted for both the football stadium in St. Louis and Busch Stadium, the baseball stadium. And I had, and like Gene was saying, I had very mixed feelings then and I have very mixed feelings now, because it's, you know, the value, if you're just looking at the dollars of it, no, it's a terrible investment for taxpayers.
But
it's bigger than that.
It is.
And it's civic pride and it's those intangibles. And it just means so much to the city to have those professional sports teams. Now, here is what I think is one potential solution, which is federal legislation, which prohibits states being put in a situation where they're bidding against each other to the detriment of the taxpayers of everybody. And I don't know how you'd craft that exactly, but
you could actually. I mean, you could literally, and you touched on a point that I've actually thought about, Ted. You could craft laws for the Congress could do it if they had the political will, which they don't. But under the Commerce Clause, obviously a sports team going from Missouri to Kansas crosses state borders. It's technically interstate commerce. So Congress would have, I think, the legislative authority under the Commerce Clause to do that. But I know there's no way ever that, and Jean's sitting here shaking her head,
nope.
There's no way ever that Congress is ever going to touch that third rail and get themselves electrocuted by trying to ban this kind of activity.
Right.
Well, as you know, the Commerce Clause is interpreted very broadly.
Oh, it surely is.
And the federal government does all kinds of things that maybe shouldn't do. But yeah, do I want Missouri to lose the teams? Absolutely not. And it maybe you have to bite the bullet and ensure that we don't lose them.
Gene, last word.
Yeah, I think it's like a lot of other businesses. We do tax credits. They did something a couple years ago for auto builders out in St. Charles. So trying to keep those businesses here, it's a competitive market. The states are out there bidding on them. That's the way it is. If you want to be in that world, you got to pay the piper.
You absolutely do. Hey, we got a hard break coming up here. I want to thank Gene Evans and Ted House. Thank you guys for joining us today, having a rather good intellectual discussion. There were no punches thrown. The medics didn't have to be called. It was a good Reardon-less roundtable. Thanks for joining us. Coming up after the break, more on the Mark Reardon Show, 97.1 FM Talk.
Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9-to-5 for a 5-to-9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Service is not available in all areas.